Europe's troika is blaming Greece, but it takes two to tango.
One of the reasons Greece presented such a catastrophic threat to the global financial system in 2000, you know, when it first got into troubles, was the fact that German and French banks were heavily invested in Greek government bonds. So if Greece defaulted, it would be those banks that would take a hit. So it sort of takes two to tango. And when Greece was going through all these good years, that was good for other Eurozone countries. Like Germany was exporting a lot of its products to Greece. So it's all very complex, and I don't think it's helpful to try and speak in terms of Greek sinners. This has dragged on now for 5 years, and there's no sense in saying that the Greeks need to be punished for what had transpired in those years. I mean, you could argue that they've been adequately punished, and therefore what needs to happen now is just a sensible plan to get over this.
That's James Angelos. We talk with him about his illuminating look at the Greek crisis, the full catastrophe. Then we talk with Peter Matthews about the sorry state of democracy in the U.S. and what to do about it. His book is Dollar Democracy. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. By the time you hear this broadcast, the outcome of the Greek debt crisis may be clearer than it is today, as this show is being produced. Today, July 1st, Greece is effectively in default. The Greek people are getting set to vote on whether to accept the draconian terms of a bailout by the so-called European Troika, and Greece has signaled it may be willing to accept the bailout terms if they come with some concessions. But the way ahead remains murky. How did Greece get to this desperate pass in the first place? My guest James Angelos explores that question in his eye-opening new book, The Full Catastrophe, Travels Among the New Greek Ruins. Angelos shows that pointing fingers at one party, whether that be Greece or the EC, is a mistake. There's plenty of blame to share. European banks and German industrialists made fat profits lending and selling to Greece during the good years, and corruption fattened the wallets of Greeks from high government ministers to lowly pensioners. Then it all came crashing down, but it's the Greek people who have disproportionately paid the price, while the EC has ridden its high horse roughshod over the ruins of the Greek economy. If knowing the causes provides a path to solutions, and I think it does, then James Angelos' fascinating book, The Full Catastrophe, illuminates the way. Angelos is a freelance journalist and former correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Prior to reporting from Europe, he wrote for the New York Times City section. Well, James Angelos, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Now, The Full Catastrophe, Travels Among the New Greek Ruins. I found this to be a really fascinating book. I think the Greek crisis is one, you know, we all know about, but few of us really know what are the issues underneath. There are a number of different narratives around the Greek crisis. But first, let's get to a little bit of the background of it. Problems had been developing for a while, but they came to a head with the global financial collapse of 2009. What happened then?
Well, after Greece joined the Eurozone in 2001, there were some very good years in Greece. It was growing on average before the crisis began, as you point out, the end of 2008, 2009. Greece was growing on average 4% a year. It was near the fastest in the Eurozone. That growth was fueled in large part by its access all of a sudden to low-interest loans. I mean, Greece, for much of its history, couldn't really borrow without paying very high interest rates because, you know, it was considered a risky place to put your money. But once it joined the Eurozone, or once it went on track to join the Eurozone, investors basically deemed it as safe as Germany or other Eurozone countries, far more stable. So based on that faith, Greece was able to borrow almost as cheaply as those other countries, so it took advantage of that. And when Lehman Brothers went under, investors started to look around at and question the safety of their investments, and they started to look at Greece and other perceived vulnerable countries in the Eurozone and said, well, is this a safe investment? So you started to see, right at the Lehman Brothers failure, you start to see divergence in the borrowing costs for Greece and other Eurozone countries. And that just, in 2009, Greece reported that its deficit numbers were actually far higher than they had previously projected. And then everything just went rapidly downhill.
And so the Troika got involved. Who are the Troika?
It's three institutions, the IMF, the European Commission, and the European Central Bank. The European Commission represents the Eurozone, essentially represents Eurozone countries. They came in as sort of the emergency borrowers, emergency lenders. So because Greece could no longer borrow from the markets, somebody else had to come in and loan them money. Greece could only borrow at very high interest rates, which was just exacerbating the problems. So they had very high deficits, high debt, and then that was just being exacerbated by the fact they were paying very high interest rates. So it was a rapidly deteriorating situation, so somebody had to step in, and these three institutions quickly came in to rescue. I wouldn't say they called it a rescue, but it was really, the priority was to preserve the global financial system, which was very shaky at the moment, and the possibility of a Greek euro exit presented serious threat to the global economy, global financial system. So the priority at the time was to do something to quickly make sure to avoid this catastrophe.
So what they did was not just emergency lending, but that lending came with conditions.
Yes. Basically, this was an excuse for the creditors to sort of look at Greece, to go in into the ministries, go in and ask questions basically about how the country was being run. And what they discovered, what these sort of technocrats discovered, was that Greece was basically in total disarray. And they have since that time used their leverage over Greece to try and push reforms, and increasingly specific reforms. We're talking about regulations to the shelf life of pasteurized milk, that they wanted changes to that, those regulations, to make the price of milk cheaper in Greece, to reforms to the tax system, to reforms to the pension system. Basically, Greece has been, for the past, since that bailout, that first bailout in 2010, Greece has been under foreign governance. The thing is, at least the way I see it, is the Greek government was in disarray. Greek government, as opposed to other nations in the Eurozone that needed bailouts, say Spain, Ireland, there was a difference between Greece and those other places. Those other places got into trouble because their banks got into trouble first. Their banks were lending irresponsible loans, and in order to prevent, again, these fires that would, basically destroy the global financial system, these governments came in and bailed out their banks. So these private debt crises became public debt crises in those other countries. In Greece, it didn't happen that way. The banks were so these sleepy institutions. The government was the transgressor, and that's a key difference.
The issues were in the public sphere, and your book goes into a number of them. I'm using the most amazing examples. Some of them, quite bizarre reading some of this. There's tax evasion and there's corruption and there's overspending. But before we get into those, let's talk a little bit about the impact of austerity, because even when the first conditions were laid down, I remember reading almost every week in the New York Times Paul Krugman's column in which he was saying, this is not going to work. And I actually wonder, why did the Troika expect that austerity would work? It was punitive to an incredible degree. First, tell us a little bit about the impact, and then give us your sense of why such punitive conditions were imposed.
I think that's a very complicated, it's a great question, and the answer is very complex, and we could probably talk about it forever and debate about it forever. But I think that there are a few issues at play. I think, number one, in 2010, the priority was not to save Greece. The priority was to keep the Eurozone intact, right? I also think that Eurozone leaders, Greece's creditors, were angry. And I think their electorates were also angry. And I thought they couldn't sort of come in and say, look, we're just going to give you money, low-interest loans now, and sort of reward you for this behavior. For better or worse, ultimately, we were talking before about how in other countries there's a private sector issues that the governments had to come in and bail out the banks. In Greece was judged more harshly than these other countries because it was the government that was the perpetrator. So there was a sense of anger and German leaders at the time were also talking about moral hazard. You know, we don't want to make an example here where if you act like this, if you do these kinds of things, we're going to come in and you know, your life will be easy. So I think there was a sense of we can't go too easy on the Greeks here. You know, in the first bailout, the loans, the sort of bailout loan interest was too high, and that created problems. I mean, Greece was paying interest on those loans, and it could have been paying a lower interest, which would have made a second bailout. The situation got progressively worse, and if the interest rates had been lower, it would have been, say, less worse. It wouldn't have been as bad. So that's one issue, this moral hazard issue. I think also, I mean, Greece was, for all those years leading up to 2008, I mean, there was money being pumped into Greece. And so the Troika deemed like that in order for Greece to become competitive again, you can't just keep that model going. You had to establish a new model of how this country would function, right? It proved it was growing unsustainably. So a new model had to be created. Now, that model that they chose was basically kind of like trying to create an export-oriented economy. So because they were going to say, okay, we're going to cut wages, we're going to cut incomes, and what that will do is we'll make the cost of business in Greece cheaper, it will make Greek exports cheaper, Greece will start exporting more, and then there'll be export-led growth in Greece. That never happened. And that's why we are here where we are today. Greece's economy under this Troika governance has a combination of Troika governance and I think also political instability in Greece over the past years has really created a situation where the economy has contracted at a Great Depression-like level. And as a result, nothing is better today, really. Greece's debt-to-GDP ratio is as high as it's ever been.
Yeah, you know, you talk about a 30% cut in incomes and unemployment. You know, I find it very interesting what you said about moral hazard.
Yeah.
That moral hazard was applied when the government was at fault, not applied when, frankly, the private banks, which crashed the global economy, I mean, they're still not paying for the moral hazard there. And they were also actually, you know, the banks were making money off of the loans that they made to Greece at that high interest rate up until a certain point. So do you think that there's a bit of a double standard here?
Yes. Not to excuse Greek governance up until the crisis hit. I think looking at these in sort of moral, looking at the issue in moral terms is probably unhelpful. Everyone has to accept the situation as it was. The Eurozone played a role in allowing it to get to the present condition. One of the reasons Greece presented such a catastrophic threat to the global financial system in 2000, you know, when it first got into troubles, was the fact that German and French banks were heavily invested in Greek government bonds. So if Greece defaulted, it would be those banks that would take a hit. So, you know, it sort of takes two to tango. And when Greece was going through all these good years, I mean, that was good for other Eurozone countries, like especially export. Germany was exporting a lot of its products to Greece, and Greece was in these boom years. And so that's not to say Germany is culpable for this. I just think that it's all very complex, and I don't think it's helpful to try and be overly moralistic about it and speak in terms of Greek sinners. This has dragged on now for 5 years, and there's no sense in saying that the Greeks need to be punished for what had transpired in those years. I mean, it's you could argue that they've been adequately punished. And therefore, what needs to happen now is just a sensible plan to get over this intractable. I mean, it's a Groundhog Day. We keep coming back to the same point where, you know, it's the 11th hour of negotiations. Will Greece default? Will Greece tumble out of the Eurozone? We've been here before. Coming back, and if there's not a longer-term solution now, we're all sides to get together and figure something out. I think we're going to be back to this point again in the not-too-distant future.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with James Angelos about his book about the Greek crisis. It's called The Full Catastrophe, Travels Among the New Greek Ruins. Now, one of the it takes two to tango examples that you explore in the book is in your chapter about the bloated defense spending on the part of the Greek government. They were buying a huge amount of arms from Germany.
Yeah, this is one of the stories that go into the book.
So Greece went on a weapons spending splurge in the late 90s, just as it was gearing up to join the Eurozone. The justification for this was a conflict over a rocky islet in the Aegean that Greece and Turkey nearly went to war over. In the aftermath of that, Greece, for a time, became the world's fourth largest arms importer. I mean, this was really used submarines and another later on for German tanks. In 2013, a Greek defense minister, who I write about in the book, was convicted of embezzling tens of millions of euros in kickbacks related to arms deals, including for the German subs. And in Germany, two managers at a company related to the deal were convicted of bribing Greek officials in connection to the deals. And now, right now, the tanks deal is also the subject of an investigation. So I talked to some top prosecutors in Greece about this, and you know, one of them told me that from about 1998 to 2002, Greece spent some 10 to 15 billion euros on armaments, and up to 10% of the value of those contracts consisted of illegal payments. So you really get a sense of how staggering the corruption was in the defense ministry in Greece. And you have to ask yourself, did Greece buy these weapons because of the threat of war, or because the same politicians who are warning of that threat are being enriched off the deals? So it was indeed a very ugly story in the end.
And not just those politicians, but of course the German arms manufacturers as well. I mean, Germany has a pretty lively arms trade, doesn't it?
Yes, indeed. Yes, it does.
Now, that's a story of a malfeasance in high places. But the issue of corruption goes pretty deeply throughout Greek society, as I think you abundantly show in this book. Let's go to the island of the blind, because in some ways that really encapsulates or is emblematic of how corruption in high places becomes corruption in low places as well.
Yeah, that's a very good way of looking at that story, because what it seemed to me, you have this example of this defense minister, it's a good juxtaposition, this defense minister sort of at the top who is, you know, embezzling all this money and spending all this, you know, billions of euros of Greek money to buy weapons the country arguably doesn't need, you know, is he buying them just because he's, you know, enriching himself off of these things? So you have that example at the top, and that's, you know, those like actual damage to Greece in terms of, you know, its deficit and debt. And then you have all the way at the bottom the example you just said, which is on Zakynthos. This is an Ionian island that I visited at the end of 2011. It was my first trip to Greece as a reporter. And I went to this island because I had heard reports that the health ministry was investigating the alleged dispensation of fraudulent blindness benefits. So there were hundreds of people allegedly on the island who were getting these benefits even though they could see. And this obviously became a big thing in the Greek media. So I went around and sort of was asking people about this. And, you know, I met one old woman who, you know, invited me to her house. And we sat in her kitchen. She explained to me how this sort of worked. In sort of cryptic language, she told me, if you have a godfather, you get baptized. If you don't have a godfather, you don't get baptized. She could see, and she told me she was getting the benefit, and she basically explained that you need, if you want a benefit like this, she called it a supplement to her pension, that she needed a patron. And to get a patron, you had to have the right, sort of vote the right way, or you needed, people alleged that the doctor got payoffs in order to give the certificate of blindness, or to make the diagnosis. He denied it. Anyway, but I met the politician who was involved, who was alleged to be involved, and the doctor as well, and also the recipient. And the story just showed how the people at the bottom were vested in the system as it existed, I thought. I mean, if you're also benefiting from the existing system in some way or another, you're less likely to try and overthrow the corruption at the top of the scale. So I think it was a way, these kinds of small-time frauds were a way of vesting the little guy in the system. And it was a very transactional political patronage system in Greece. So if you voted for a particular guy, you would get, or a particular parliamentarian, you would get a very direct reward, whether that was a government job for your niece or something along those lines. And that sort of added up. I mean, the problem is that adds up and creates big problems.
Yeah, I mean, I think it really shows how to make corruption a really intractable problem, because it's so endemic. Now, another huge issue that was bandied about in the international press, you know, I found it a little bit ironic, because in the U.S., so many politicians are always saying, you know, we should pay lower and lower taxes. But when it came to Greece, there was a lot of indignation over people not paying their taxes, over tax evasion. However, this is a real issue because it means that government does not get the receipts it needs, the income that it needs. So talk about the tax evasion issue. How real of a problem was it? What are its roots and who's responsible?
I heard a lot of theories about the roots, and I think they're kind of revealing. I'll give you one theory. I spoke to, when I was reporting this story about Zakynthos, this island, I met with the deputy health minister in his office in the health ministry in Athens, and he tried to explain to me the sort of fraught relationship between the Greek citizen and state in terms of the fact. He goes, you know, you, a guy like you, although I'm Greek-American, you know, he's like, a guy like you couldn't understand this because you're an American. You grew up in a country where, you know, it wasn't under foreign domination like we were. And I was like, no, please explain. And he said that under the Ottoman reign, for 4 to 5 centuries of Ottoman reign in Greece, you were a patriot and it was great if you could defraud the Ottomans by not paying your taxes. And even beyond that, when Greece first became a state, a modern state, in a kingdom in 1832, the first king was sent from Bavaria. He was a Bavarian prince. He was like a teenager at the time who, you know, Greeks had basically no say in who was going to be the king. It was decided by European powers. And, you know, he's saying, you know, the court, they were speaking German there. I mean, they brought Bavarian soldiers. So still the Greeks sitting there, you know, why would I pay taxes to this state? So he was explaining in terms of this sense of, you know, resistance to foreign control has generated this resistance to just government mentality, sort of anti-government feeling imbued in Greeks. I'm a little bit skeptical of that explanation, but that's one, you hear that often in Greece. I think also what I felt when I was there, what I picked up on, I think there's a difference in Greece between loyalty to the state as it exists today and loyalty to the ethnos, which is sort of the nation in Greek, because Greeks perceive their history to be millennia old, and they perceive it, although there is sometimes, you know, people can joke about it, but at the same time, people take very seriously their sort of ancient legacy. And I think that what that does is there's a difference between your loyalty to the nation, because, you know, the nation has been lasted for millennia, and the state, you know, what state can embody such a grandiose past? You know, the grandeur of the past can't be encapsulated by this modern Greek state, which is, you know, dysfunctional anyway. So you can still be sort of a Greek patriot, right? You can still be a very proud Greek and, you know, not pay your taxes. This doesn't equate, you know, because the government itself is not the same thing as the identity, sort of Greek identity. So I think that sort of the Greece's image of its long past also creates possibly this sort of fraught relationship with the current government. And perhaps if you're like in Denmark, you know, you don't think in terms of centuries, you think of, you know, your state as, you know, the nation as what's existing today and the services that it provides. And so there's a trust that if you hand over your tax money to the government, you'll be returned in good services and good. That doesn't exist in Greece.
We're talking with James Angelos about his book, The Full Catastrophe, Travels Among the New Greek Ruins. Well, this sense of nationalism is something that infuses, in some ways, responsible for the rise of both the extreme right as well as the left. And I won't say extreme left because I don't think you can equate Greece's left wing and now government, you know, with the Golden Dawn. But nonetheless, the same kind of nationalist fervor, but in different ways, infuses both. And with Golden Dawn, a kind of xenophobia against immigration, and there's a very powerful chapter that you write about immigrants. And Syriza, on the other hand, this sense of we are going to throw off the neoliberal yoke being imposed upon us by the Northern Europeans.
Yeah, you made a very good point by not, I think people often make a mistake by saying, you know, the rise of the extremes in Greece and then no series would be equated to Golden Dawn, which is a fascist party that exercised its sort of ideology of violence on the streets of Athens, going around beating, I mean, having assault squads going around and beating immigrants. So in terms of the Golden Dawn's brand of nationalism, ultra-nationalism, is they actually, in their anthem, call themselves the New Spartans. A lot of their leaders are from the region of the Peloponnese where ancient Sparta once was. And so they really see themselves, they trace their legacy back to that period, and you get a sense of how the ancient legacy can be corrupted to mean something, to be devoid of its, you know, original substance and be made into some kind of Nazi case for, you know, even racial superiority of the Hellenes. I mean, it was really, it's taken to the extreme. And so that's the one, that's the extreme end of that scale. On the other end, not to equate Syriza's sort of brand of nationalism is more in terms of this resistance. I was amazed when I was there at how everything is, you know, that the Syriza's resistance to German-led austerity was often put in terms of the war resistance in World War II. A lot of people don't know this, but Greece was occupied by the Axis during World War II, and it was a particularly brutal occupation. And during the time, a communist-led resistance force really fought back and wrestled control of much of the Greek interior. So, you know, Syriza, in large part, traces its sort of spiritual heritage to this resistance force. And it was no surprise then that right after Syriza was elected in the end of January and Tsipras was inaugurated, one of the first things he did, was to go, as prime minister, was to go to the site of a shooting range that is now a memorial where hundreds of Greek partisans and communists were executed by the Nazis during the war. And behind him, a bunch of supporters were chanting slogans of praise for the communist-led war resistance. So that was a highly symbolic visit, and basically what he was saying was, I'm going to carry on this torch of resistance. And now he's resisting the German-led, what people in Greece often refer to as the economic occupation of Greece. Mm-hmm. So it's a very emotional issue. You know, the idea of resistance is very emotional in Greece, and it strikes a nerve, and Syriza has really capitalized on that.
Yes, and I wish we could talk longer. This is just a wonderful book. You know, we've talked about a lot of the issues here, but you really show the issues in the context of the most incredible stories, where you did travel throughout the new Greek ruins. And there were times I had to laugh out loud. I mean, it was almost the theater of the absurd. But I really came away with a much more nuanced understanding of the issues. And I want to thank you so much, James Angelos, talking with us here about the full catastrophe.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
James Angelos is a freelance journalist and former correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. He lives in Berlin. Next up, we talk with Peter Matthews about his book, Dollar Democracy. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Ever since a 2010 Supreme Court ruling in Citizens United, the influence of corporate money in politics has ballooned to gargantuan proportions. But as our next guest, Peter Matthews, experienced firsthand, that influence long predates that historic ruling. He ran for Congress in 1998, going up against a candidate who was well-funded by corporate interests. Matthews ran a surprisingly close race, but his shoestring operation fell short of victory, hampered by his refusal to take money from corporate-funded PACs. He went on to become a political analyst and teach political science at the college level. Matthew's book, Dollar Democracy, With Liberty and Justice for Some, lays out the case clearly for separating the powers of politics and the purse, and how to do it. I spoke with Matthews the very day Bernie Sanders declared his candidacy for President of the United States, a candidacy that also refuses to take big money, and one that Matthews supports. Peter Matthews teaches political science at Cypress College and is currently a political analyst on the Head On radio show in Los Angeles, California. He was a Democratic Party nominee for the U.S. Congress in 1998 in Long Beach. Peter Matthews, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's so good to be here with you, Francesca.
This book, Dollar Democracy, I really thought this was kind of an inside account. You know, a lot of the territory that it covers is stuff that is out there, but you really give an insider's account because you yourself ran for office and you experienced, what do you call it, not the legalized bribery because you didn't do that, but, you know, the pay-to-play
right.
system. Yeah,
sure, I call it dollar democracy. That's what I experienced and the effects of it. Pernicious conditions that you have to put up with when you're running for office, especially if you reject dollar democracy, which I did.
And you were doing this pre-Citizens United back in 1998.
Right.
You were a Democratic Party nominee for the U.S. Congress, and you ran a close race, although
right.
you weren't really close in the amount. You had a lot less money than your opponent. So, and
my opponent outspent me about 5-1, and we still won 45% of the vote, and he got about 52%. Not bad for that kind of a disparity.
Yeah, that's really excellent, particularly for a progressive candidate, I'd say.
I ran on a very progressive platform, and people responded. You know, I spoke in college classes and in churches. I went door-to-door with hundreds of volunteers, including many former students and educators. And we had a great response from the community because people saw that we cared, and we were coming right to their doorstep to talk to them and with them. And I took part in debates as well, not too many because the incumbent didn't really want to debate me. He had the inside track, you know? So he had a lot more money. So a lot of times they don't want to debate you when they have more money and they're going to win.
You talk about a very interesting meeting that your campaign manager forced you to attend with the ARCO
yes.
PAC. Tell us what that was and what your experience with that was.
Well, it's very remarkable because the first time that I actually got to interview with a big corporate PAC, I didn't really want to do it, but my campaign manager said, let's just go at least and listen to what they have to say. And I said, okay, we'll do that because I wasn't going to accept corporate money, but I went ahead and decided to interview with the ARCO PAC. So I walk into this gleaming office building, you know, with beautiful air conditioned, cooled air, and a nice receptionist inviting me in and escorting me to the table where there were about 10 or 15 committee members. And the chair of the committee, you know, he started asking me questions. First of all, I shook their hands. I tried to break the ice nicely, and it went well. And then they asked me questions, you know, why are you running for Congress? And I told them why, because I really want to serve American people, especially the regular folks who don't have representation in Congress, and that I believe that there's too much money at the very top because of corporate tax loopholes and not enough funds for our mass public education to be fully funded, including college education and K-12. And I said, we can close the loopholes and bring the money in for universal preschool, for universal adequate funding for K-12, and for tuition-free college, which I think would be great, as they did in California 30, 40 years ago. We had tuition-free education. I gave them the examples, real-life evidence. And I also talked about infrastructure, needing to rebuild our infrastructure and using the money for that. And we could even use some of the money to pay down the debt by closing the unfair, unproductive corporate tax loopholes. I gave them an example of an oil severance tax loophole, which I'm sure they were benefiting from in California, since we're the only state in the union that produces oil that does not have a severance tax on the oil. And so they didn't like those things, but they were kind of looking at me, is this guy for real? Is he telling us this stuff right to our face? And I said, well, I'm going to keep going. So the question then after that question, they were basically, it was time to say goodbye, and they would just ask me a few innocuous questions, and then they let me go after about 5 minutes, and I said, thank you for your time, and they said, thank you for your time. I never heard from them again. So I knew that I wouldn't, because I didn't really want to be, you know, bought by them. And so I told them the truth.
And you were following in the footsteps and the example of one of my heroes, and I know he's one of yours. That's Paul Wellstone.
Senator Paul Wellstone. What a wonderful human being. And I knew him personally. It was such an honor to even have met him and meet Sheila, his wife, who also was a fighter for social justice. She fought for the rights of battered women to be able to recover and to not be battered and to have shelter for them. And Paul introduced legislation like that later on. You know, he was a champion of that, also for social justice, for universal single-payer health care. His ideas were almost exactly like mine in terms of fairness and equality of opportunity and paying for it through making sure the big corporations pay their fair share of taxes. And I got to, Paul actually campaigned for me at a Beverly Hills speech that he made at a dinner that we went to, and I got to meet them at that time. And so the 2002 election, it was the third time he was standing for re-election for the U.S. Senate. He was 9 points ahead because he had just surged when he voted to not support going into war in Iraq. He's the only Democrat up for re-election who voted to not support it, and his numbers went up, and he was about to win the third term of Francesca in 2002, and so tragically, just a few days before the election, he and his wife and his daughter and the two pilots in the airplane went down in a plane crash in northern Minnesota, and they all passed away.
You know,
his memory lives on, and his example lives on, his inspiration.
You know, there are actually some people who think that he was murdered.
I certainly wouldn't put that past it, because I read some information in a book by Michael Rupert, who said that once the plane crashed and the rescue people were called, that the federal government investigators walled it all off, roped it off, and didn't allow the state and local people to come in. And it took the federal government 1 year to decide what happened, and they basically said it was mechanical failure, which is unbelievable because the weather was good. The CNN reporter on the ground was saying the sun was shining. Other planes flew in and flew out with no problem. So it is very sad because when he died, the U.S. Senate switched hands by one vote to the Republicans as a majority, and George Bush had the people he needed to back him the rest of the war. It was horrible.
Exactly.
And what I like about Wellstone, he was for progressive issues, for peace and justice, without taking corporate money. He won in 1990 by just 1% of the vote, and then he kept going with higher percentages. So that was a very big tragedy with what happened with George Bush being able to go full force ahead.
And how did he win? Because he was your model.
Yes, he ran the way I did, without corporate money, with lots of volunteers. The only difference is that in California, we have a kind of voter population that relies a lot on mass media. They like to see TV commercials and gloss mailings, brochures mailed in their mailboxes. Well, Wellstone in Minnesota, the people are much more down to earth in terms of having actual town hall meetings and bean suppers and getting together on grassroots campaigning. And he reached a lot of people that way, and they responded. And I didn't have the funds. You have to have a certain basic level of funds to be able to get the message out. Wellstone did have about $1.7 million, and Boschwitz outspent him 7-1, but he still had $1.7 million to TV commercials. I only had $60,000, and Horn had like $500,000. So I didn't have the money to do even more than one mailing. I could only do like a partial mailing to some of the voters. It's very tough, even though you go door-to-door for 2 years. You only cover about 10% of the voters, 15,000 voters, and then you end up losing by a few percent because you don't have the money to do the last 2 weeks of mailing in California, targeted mailing, which reminds the voters who you are, what you stand for. And that's what killed us, basically. That's what got us to lose by a few percent and allowed Paul to win, although I think the stars came together also to help Paul out. But I can't take anything away from his tremendous campaign efforts and his record of being a man of the people and struggling throughout the community for years for justice. That record helped him in the end win by 1.5%, I think.
And we're here to talk about your book, and we will, but I cannot hold back my question because today is the day that Bernie Sanders declared his presidency, to campaign for the presidency of the United States. In some ways, he's a figure like Paul Wellstone.
Yeah.
He doesn't have huge coffers either. What's your take on his campaign?
I was just delighted to hear him officially declare because I met with him about 3 weeks ago at a union hall where he spoke. And we all encouraged him to run, regardless. And he was a bit hesitant. He said, you know, as long as we have enough support, I'll do it. We said, we're here. We're supporting you. So he decided yesterday or today to announce. And I believe that he's going to really shift the debate, which we need to have a real debate within the Democratic Party, between Hillary Clinton and him, or anyone else who runs, really shift the debate to be more inclusive of progressive ideas. If Hillary had been the only candidate, we would have had another corporate Democrat basically walking right in and then not being challenged on the issues of money in politics or if the lack of universal health care, the lack of access to colleges, and it would have been terrible. And I think now it's a good thing that Bernie's running and he will be on the debate platform. He's the U.S. Senator for, after all, sort of like Paul Wellstone. That's a wonderful thing, I think. We'll have to get behind him and give him, donate individual money because he doesn't take corporate money or lobbyist money. we have to go out there and do grassroots campaigning for him, and we might be able to at least make a major impact. I would love to see him win, obviously.
Yeah, I actually have just donated today to his campaign.
Very nice. I'll be next.
Now, what do you think about the prospects for this kind of debate right now? I mean, it seems to me that the Occupy movement back in 2011 mm-hmm. opened the conversation on income inequality. So it is far broader today than it ever was before.
That's right.
Do you think that things are different? Do you think that actually Bernie could do the Democratic candidate some good by shifting the debate to the left?
Absolutely. And you're right, the awareness and the amount of disparity is humongous. I mean, here's some numbers that are in my book. The country's 400 richest people today have the same aggregate net worth. They have the same amount of wealth as half the population, 150 million ordinary Americans. The ratio of CEO salary, it was 40 to 1 back in 1980. The average CEO made about 40 times the income of the average worker. Today, it is 331 to 1. So the top 1% captured 93% of the new income generated since 2009. So it's going on and on. Occupy was an excellent movement that pointed out this disparity, and I don't believe they had a common platform or a common leadership, but yet they were doing the democratic thing, small d, by getting the word out and getting the people on the street and in the parks. And with that kind of awareness, and with someone like Bernie championing those progressive causes that Occupy basically many individuals stood for and I stand for, I think the debate's going to get shifted in a positive way toward the progressive side, and Hillary Clinton will have to address issues she may have left on the table, left under the table.
Would that help her in the general election?
Absolutely, yes, because then she'll bring in, if she starts adopting some of Bernie Sanders' platform and pushing it hard, especially the income disparity, also how to create jobs, that's the most important thing, and bringing back Glass-Steagall. Why did we get rid of Glass-Steagall, led by a Democratic president, Hillary's own husband, and the Republicans abolished Glass-Steagall and caused the banking crisis that we had in 2008 to a large extent? So she needs to address those things. Bernie will bring them up, and it'll strengthen her because she'll have to be forced to take the progressive side on some of these key issues.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Peter Matthews. He's a professor of political science at Cypress College and a former candidate, Democratic Party nominee for U.S. Congress in 1998, where he ran a close race in the Long Beach, California district. His book is Dollar Democracy with Liberty and Justice for Some. So
there is a subtitle, Francesca, How to Reclaim the American Dream for All, because the book has a whole chapter on how to win back the dream, how to get over dollar democracy.
Yes, and I think that's we'll make sure to cover that. But before we do, and you go over a lot of issues, which we won't have time to do all of them today, but I think we should touch on some of them. Healthcare. You talk about the Affordable Care Act falling short. What happened there? What happened to the public option? Why have things not panned out quite the way we had all hoped? Although, clearly it's better than it was before.
Right. I call it a small step in the right direction, and it has done good things for young people. For example, keeping them on their parents' insurance till they're 26 years old if they're in college rather than being dropped at 21. So the ACA was a good act. It just wasn't far enough. And I believe it's because of dollar democracy, because these wealthy corporate insurers and HMOs who oppose a public option, they oppose single payer, as Paul Wellstone supported. It made President Obama a little shy about putting it out there. He did put the public option out there, but it got struck down by the Congress, and he didn't fight back. He didn't even put the single payer option out there, which should have been there from the beginning. And that's why I say it's not as good as it nearly could be. And it's still going to leave 20 million Americans uncovered. It's going to have the same problems with co-payments and deductibles, which actually make people go broke in many cases. And I believe we need to move to a public option or a single-payer system. And that's why I love Bernie Sanders supporting single-payer. He'll bring that out there. And Hillary will be forced, in my view, to take a position on it. So that's why healthcare did not get reformed fully. But we're the only advanced industrial country with no comprehensive healthcare system. As you know, Canada has a single-payer system, which covers everyone with no payments, no co-payments, no deductibles, and it does it for two-thirds of the cost per person. Britain has a national health service, which works very well overall, and they do it for one-half the cost, less than one-half the cost. In France, which was rated the top healthcare system in the world by the World Health Organization, I believe, they actually do it for about one-half the cost of the American system and cover every one of their people. They even have house calls that doctors make in France. So it's amazing. Other countries are doing it, and we haven't even come close to it. And by the way, something else, Francesca, It really makes our businesses less competitive. Do you know it costs $1,000 more to build the same automobile in Detroit, or in the United States, I should say, as it does that it costs to build the same car in Canada, because the Canadian corporation doesn't have to pay for health care. Whereas here, the corporations, half of the people here are covered by their corporate employers or just employers. And that cuts into the profit margin, it cuts into competitiveness, and it's an overburdening, wasteful way of spending health care money.
So let's talk about education, because I remember when education was practically free. I think I paid $1,200 a year as an out-of-state student at the University of Wisconsin for tuition and fees. My mother went to Brooklyn College for free. What has happened there? How has dollar democracy undermined our education system?
In a very big way, because in California, we also had tuition-free education. In 1960, Governor Pat Brown, the current governor's father, and the Democratic legislature, but Republicans also supported it, they brought in the Master Plan for Higher Education, which actually required tuition-free education with a very, very small service fee. So the UC Berkeley students, one of which was later Governor Pete Wilson, he paid $37 service fee at a law school. That's 3 years beyond the bachelor's. And it was $37 for all 15 units, even undergraduate. My friend Garver, Dr. Paul Garver, paid $600 a year at UCLA Medical School all the way to 1979 when he graduated. $600 a year, Francesca, no debt. So that was something we had because American leaders believed in the ethics and the morality of the proposition that education is a human right to be guaranteed to all. It's not a privilege to be earned. It's an ethical issue. I think it goes back to the Declaration of Independence. For example, the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, said Jefferson. Well, two of those can't be had without good health or health care, life and pursuit of happiness. So it's so outrageous that they ignore that completely. We need inspiring leaders who will bring those high-level ideas and ethical standards and use that as the basis of a comprehensive, nonprofit, public education system, higher education. We could do it. You said your mother, was it, who went to Brooklyn College?
Mm-hmm.
And you went to University of Wisconsin with $1,200 a year, did you say, or a semester?
A year, and that was a year, and that was as an out-of-state student.
As an out-of-state student, $1,200 a year. Right now, the in-state UC students at UC Berkeley, UCLA are paying $13,000 a year, the tuition alone, not room and board, not books. So you are getting a much better deal as an out-of-state student than our very in-state students today in California, and that's outrageous. I'm a professor. I have lots of students who want to go to the UCs. They're transferring from my community college classes, and they're being completely shut out. Many middle-class students' parents make a little bit too much money to qualify for the basic governor's waiver or BOG grant. It's 100% tuition-free. And yet, the parents don't make enough for them to pay fully for the student's education, so they have to pay the $46 per unit for community college. And that's way more than they're used to paying. Plus, the cost of rents are outrageous. We got a report today showing that in L.A. County and Southern California overall, the many, many people in the working middle class and working poor are paying two-thirds of their income in rent alone. That leaves virtually nothing left. It shoots up the poverty level and poverty rates way up, which have just expanded to beyond 23% in this area. K through 12 is a bigger part, another part, Francesca. Our K through 12 system, as I deal with in my book, I show that in the United States of America, our K through 12 funding, our K through 12 funding for education is the most inequitable in the world, in the Western world. We allow in New York, for example, the average per pupil spending in public schools is $17,000 a year. In California, it is $8,500 a year. In Northern California, the wealthy communities like Marin County, it is $18,000 a year per pupil spending. And in Southgate, near Los Angeles, it is less than $8,000 a year. In Long Beach, about $9,000 a year. And so you have these disparities in the funding mechanism. But I also had a remarkable finding. In sociological studies that I've researched, it's been found that the single greatest predictor of a child in America's chance of getting a good education and therefore in going on being successful in life is the parental income. The lower income parents, their children have one heck of a time and challenge and hurdles to jump over, and many of them don't make it in getting a college degree and doing well in high school. The upper and middle class and the upper class children, they do very well. Even if the per pupil funding is the same, the wealthier parents' areas, the children do better because the wealthier parents have the resources to put them in after-school tutoring programs, arts programs. And frankly, the arts have not been cut in those wealthier areas. They've been cut in the lower-income areas. And the support system of the parents in the lower-income areas is very fragile. They're working more than one job. they're being working overtime, any of them. Sometimes it's single parents. But still, even if it's both parents are there, it's very hard for them to help their children with homework or to do other things like get them their children tutoring classes or dance classes. That is a complete disparity, and we know that outside activity influences the learning in the classroom, outside support systems. That's lacking.
And connect the dots for us. Tell us, what has been the impact of dollar democracy, and title of your book, Peter Matthews, what has been the influence of dollar democracy on what's happened to education?
I'll give you an example. We have so many corporate tax loopholes, and my book lists 40 corporations that paid zero income tax in 2012 while making hundreds of millions, even billion a year. I'll give you one example is Facebook. They made $1.02 billion in 2012 and paid zero income tax legally because the Congress voted for them corporate loopholes for all companies like them. And those corporate tax loopholes are laws that are legal. They're legal rules that allow them not to write off all their income and not pay tax. And on top of that, the government wrote them a check for $429 million as corporate welfare to promote their products around the world. This happened with other companies like oil companies like Occidental Petroleum on my list and energy companies. Every one of these big corporations has tax write-offs and they get money from the government. And that's where the money's gone. So it's not going into public education from the federal or state level. The same thing exists at the state level. The state corporate loopholes are sucking up the money into the hands of big companies and taking it away from the subsidies that the state could provide for high school students in the K-12s here. So that's been cut. Look at our community colleges. They were cut by one-third in the last few years since the recession. From a $3 billion budget a year, they got like a $2-point-something billion, almost $800 million cut. That's almost a one-third cut, which means less sections offered to the students to graduate on time, more impacted majors like our nursing major at Cypress College. You have to wait 2 years to get in, and other colleges too, and yet nurses are in demand. So those cuts in subsidies to K through university from the states and the federal government have been due to dollar democracy because those were the dollars. They got the democracy. They got the write-offs, the corporate loopholes, the laws passed in their favor, and they've taken the money and run. And it's shown in the disparity between rich and poor in America right now, which has been growing tremendously.
So let's talk about some of the solutions, because as you point out, one of the subtitles of your book is How to Reclaim the American Dream for All. You suggest a 28th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution.
Yeah, 28th Amendment, and particularly the one that's proposed by the Move to Amend organization, the coalition, it's called Move to Amend Coalition, and their website's movetoamend.org. This group, made up of about almost 400,000 signatories across the U.S., hundreds of organized groups that are supporting them in the coalition, and they even have co-sponsors in Congress. It was just introduced yesterday in the U.S. House as House Joint Resolution 48 by Congressmember Rick Nolan of Minnesota and about six or seven other members of Congress who are co-sponsors. And what it would do is two simple things, Francesca, which will revolutionize our democracy. It would remove corporate personhood. Right now, the Supreme Court ruled back in 1886 that right now corporations are natural persons with natural rights of human beings, protected by the first 10 amendments to the Constitution and the 14th Amendment, giving them all kinds of rights, including the right to free speech, which means they can use their money and buy the elections. Because the Supreme Court also decided in 1976 in Buckley versus Vallejo that money is equal to speech, and therefore it cannot be regulated in any significant way. Money is equal to speech. Corporations are people. So corporations can spend as much of their money as they want in elections, in propositions, and initiatives, and buy the system. So this amendment would basically even the playing field one more time by taking out this kind of power from corporations. They can still make money. They can still be entrepreneurial. They can still make profits and pay workers a decent wage, but they cannot buy the government once this amendment passes. And that's what I'd like to see happen. I'm very active in that movement, and that would help us help these people who are elected without corporate dollars to be able to serve the public interest like they do in the states of Maine and Arizona, especially in Maine, pioneering states in the Clean Money Elections campaign. You've heard of Clean Money Elections in the Northeast? They're basically public finance elections, voluntary public financing of elections. The state of Maine was the pioneer. The voters of Maine passed the law, the Clean Money Bill, back in 1996. It was finally implemented in 2000. And according to the bill, the law that's in act now, it's in place, the people in Maine can run for office, for state assembly, state senate, for example. And to run for state assembly as a clean money candidate, you have to collect $5 each from 65 voters in the district, and that's a nominating fee. It's a $5 fee. Then you turn that dollar, those $300 or so, over to the election commission, and the Maine Election Commission puts you on the ballot automatically as a clean money candidate. You can use that label, but you have to agree not to spend any private money, not to raise your own money or even spend your own money if it's private money or corporate money or anything. You only have to rely on the public check that the government then writes you to run your campaign. Once you become a clean money candidate, the government writes you a check for several thousand dollars to reach the several thousand voters in your district. And then you can focus on debates, town hall meetings, going door to door, and hearing what the voters' desires and needs are. And then you serve them when you're elected. And exactly what happened in Maine in the year right after this clean money bill in 2000 when it was first used, 80% of the Maine legislators were clean money elected. And Maine became the first state in the union to bring about a near comprehensive universal health care. It came out to about 93% coverage almost right away, you know, 12 years before we brought it, or Obama's trying to bring it. Maine was the pioneer because they got rid of that corporate money, that special interest money, and brought about clean money elections. So that has to be another option in my book. It's the second option after the 28th Amendment. The only problem is that Maine used to have a matching fund system where in their law, as the dirty money candidate raised more and more private money, you as his clean money opponent would be able to get a check from the government, a second check and a third check to match the dirty money candidate's amount. So it's an even playing field. The Supreme Court struck down that part of the law recently in Arizona. An Arizona private money, dirty money candidate complained that his free speech was being violated by the clean money candidate, and so matching funds were ruled unconstitutional. But Maine has other ways of people who are in the clean money camp raising more money by getting more signatures. So they're getting around it. And I think while we're waiting on the 28th Amendment, clean money elections is a very important alternative. We should have that at the national level. And the last one that I offer as a real possibility for change is a Senator Wellstone-type campaign. That we should force all of these politicians, we the people should get up in arms, peacefully, of course, and force these politicians to reject corporate lobbyist money and to only run on individual small contributions and volunteer help. I've actually put that in the next edition of my book that's coming out. And in the chapter at the end, we have an action plan in which we ask the voters. We give them access. We give them a website that in which they can find out exactly who their member of House and Senate are, their phone numbers. And when they get that those phone numbers, they need to start calling their congressman immediately and say, you know, you work for us. We pay your salary. And you need to bring about real democracy and social justice, no longer corporate lobbyist democracy and dollar democracy. So you also to get them to support the clean money, I mean, the 28th Amendment to become co-sponsors. That's kind of action plan that we have, basically. And the more we talk about it on radio and everywhere else, it'll be the better.
Well, that's great and very exciting. And I have to tell people that your book is really chock full of a whole lot of interesting information. They're going to learn new facts and new ways of talking to the people that they care about these issues.
Very nice.
So, Peter Matthews, thanks so much for talking to us about Dollar Democracy with Liberty and Justice for Some and How to Reclaim the American Dream for All.
That's wonderful. And if people want to reach me, my website is epetermatthews.com. It's spelled with one T. So, epetermatthews.com. Love to hear from them.
You can read excerpts from Peter Matthews' Dollar Democracy with Liberty and Justice for Some by going to writersvoice.net. We also provide links to the campaign for the 28th Amendment. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.